a shakeup in Indiana's race for attorney general. Republicans reject some election changes, plus worker safety enforcement and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 24th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, a shakeup in the Republican race for Attorney General as Decatur County Prosecutor Nate Harder announced his bid while former Department of Revenue Commissioner Adam Krupp dropped out. Nate Harder is in his second term as Decatur County Prosecutor. The conservative lawyer says he's running for Attorney General because the office is the, quote, tip of the spear or last line of defense against big government and the radical left. Harder hopes to oust sitting Attorney General Curtis Hill, who's been under fire the last 2 years for sexual misconduct allegations. As Harder joins the race, Adam Krupp departs it. Krupp, a former Holcomb, Pence, and Daniels administration official, is endorsing Harder. Krupp says his campaign for the office was hurt by the COVID-19 pandemic, and he acknowledged attacks against him for past donations to Barack Obama and a close friend who ran for office as a Democrat. The GOP convention race for the nomination is now between Harder, Hill, and Indianapolis attorney John Westerkamp. What does this do to the AG race? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, does this make it more or less likely that Curtis Hill will be renominated?
Well, I think it makes it more likely. I mean, I think Krupp was the establishment candidate of choice to try to defeat Curtis Hill. But now you have a three-way split, and you have Curtis Hill with his followers. I mean, apparently a lot of the people who go to the Republican State Convention don't care about the fact that Curtis Hill's boorish conduct in assaulting four different women and then lying about it at the same time he's trying to deprive, 400,000 Hoosiers of health care? They don't seem to be bothered by those facts. And I guess that's probably consistent with their support for Donald Trump, who's done the same thing. So I think it makes it more likely because this kid, and I say that advisedly, he doesn't have an awful lot of experience out of Decatur County, to run for the Attorney General of the state. But I think it makes it more likely that Curtis Hill will be the nominee.
Mike O'Brien, same question.
And then lose.
Mike O'Brien, what is the same question? Same question to you. What does this do to Curtis Hill's chances?
Well, it's interesting because Nate Harder, you'll recall, was a big Curtis Hill supporter. And so they do draw from the same constituency. And so if Nate can pair that and make inroads into that group, while in addition pick up the quote-unquote establishment support, the Republican support that Adam Krupp already had, then I think he's going to be in a pretty strong position with that delegate map.
Yeah, John Schwannis, Nate Harder was on Curtis Hill's transition team. He's acted as a surrogate for the AG's office at Republican events before. I think Nikki Kelly pointed out that he nominated Curtis Hill. He was the one to officially nominate Curtis Hill at the convention 4 years ago. Does that make it more likely that he can beat him?
Well, I think Mike's assessment is on target. If here's somebody who is familiar and agreeable to the same wing of the party, the same constituency that the current attorney general has. So he won't be seen as necessarily as so much of the Republican establishment that is trying to unseat this wrongly accused or at least mistreated elected official. So I think if you do tap into that constituency, which again is Curtis Hill's constituency, you're hoping to get some of the establishment along. The establishment may not love him, Nate Harder, or his rhetoric about, the liberals, he's the tip of the spearhead and so forth. But look at the alternative. Where else do they go? Yes, there's another candidate. But in terms of the marquee candidates, they may hold their noses and say, okay, this is where we go anyway. So I don't know. I think there's more to all this than someday maybe Michael Bryan will write the book and tell us what really happened behind the scenes here.
Never.
Nikki Kelly, what happened with Adam Krupp?
Well, obviously, he just couldn't gain enough traction. I think toward the end, some donations that he gave back then to Barack Obama and also to a good friend of his who ran for something as a Democrat, those were being brought up and his conservative credentials were being challenged. So obviously, I think party insiders decided they needed to go with someone they thought was a little more sure of a bet.
All right. Well,
Brandon, I think that's part of the difference between having a convention selection and a primary selection. You know, when Michael Braun ran for Senate, he had voted in Democratic primaries before, but he had enough money to sell himself to the general public. Whereas in a convention, those kinds of slips, as Nikki pointed out, can be fatal.
Yeah. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question we've asked before, but we're updating it now. Who will be the Republican nominee for Attorney General? A, Nate Harder, B, Curtis Hill, or C, John Westerkamp, or perhaps D, someone else? Last week's question, when should Governor Holcomb reopen Indiana's economy? These results fascinated me. 22% of you said early May, when the governor has indicated some businesses may start to reopen. 24% say he should wait until later in that month. 24% said June, and 30% said in July or later. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Republicans on the Indiana Election Commission rejected Democrats' attempt to loosen some restrictions for the June 2nd primary election. The state had already pushed back the election from May in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The commission approved further changes to the primary, such as limiting in-person voting to the week leading up to and including Election Day, but Democrats pushed for more. One proposal would allow Hoosiers to request an absentee vote-by-mail ballot up to 8 days before the election, instead of the current 12. Another would allow those absentee ballots to come in as late as 3 days after June 2nd. Right now, they must be in by noon on Election Day. Here's commission member Susanna Wilson-Overholt.
The purpose of this amendment is to essentially recognize that the Postal Service may slow down, the mails may slow through the Postal Service as a result of the pandemic.
Commission Chair Paul Okeson says those issues were already discussed privately before the meeting.
Yet we came to some agreement and passed an order that did not contain the information that you're proposing in those amendments. Which, forgive me, seems a bit disingenuous.
The commission's GOP members didn't explain any further why they rejected the Democrats' proposals. Mike O'Brien, there were quite a few amendments proposed by the Democrats, but I want to kind of focus in on the two, for instance, that I mentioned, which is allowing a little more time for absentee ballot applications to come in, back to 8 days, which, by the way, was what the state had been for quite a few number of years before a very recent change in state law, and allowing absentee ballots themselves to be counted if they come in a couple of days late. Why not make some of these changes?
Well, what's lost in this is that the chairs of the Indiana Democratic Party and the Indiana Republican Party and the Bipartisan Election Commission all came to an agreement on what that order was going to say, and it passed unanimously on the changes that were going to be brought to this election. We obviously moved the election to June 2nd. They approved this week guidance to allow in-person early voting and in-person election day voting following certain protocols, opened up absentee voting by mail, which I did this morning. And so they've made a lot of changes. These changes were just brought in. The purpose of that meeting was to approve the order that was agreed upon by both political parties and the Election Commission. It wasn't to consider brand new proposals. And you do begin to have an impact if you just start accepting ballots after election. If you continue accepting ballots after the election day, it alters the timeline of when the election is certified and other changes that may or may not even be legal. And so those may be perfectly acceptable recommendations, but they've got to be, most of them have to be considered by the legislature.
And Delaney, Mike O'Brien pointed out, as Chair Paul Okeson said, you know, the election commission members bipartisanly agreed to this. The two state party chairs already agreed to the language in the order. Was it disingenuous for Democrats to throw these things up in the public meeting after everything had been agreed to?
Not at all. And these things were not discussed for the first time at the public meeting. What the Democrats did in this was get the best deal they could to extend the voting and make it easier for people, consistent with having the Republicans on the Election Commission who are opposed to opening up voting and making it generally more acceptable. But the fact that they agreed to that and they voted for it doesn't mean we can't continue to discuss the fact that Indiana is consistently in the bottom 10 of states in terms of turnout. Now, this is a big step forward. I'll grant you that. This is the first time we've done something like this, but we haven't gone far enough. We should have mail voting all the time, and we should have it as easy as possible. Even the photo ID requirement was a way to depress the vote. And it's time we recognize that and recognize the fact that we're in the 21st century and we can start behaving in our voting places as if we are. Now, you know, we're going to continue to talk about these issues until we get Indiana where it ought to be in the top 10 of states in terms of turnout instead of the bottom 10.
Nikki Kelly, the Election Commission at its meeting this week took some public testimony, but it also acknowledged that it's going to have to meet again in May to extend some of their orders that they've already made through the June 2nd election, kind of a pro forma thing. But they will discuss any further changes needed. Do you, though, foresee any further changes to the primary election?
I don't. I mean, I think that Republicans have settled on the what they have agreed to, and they are happy with the current format that they've come up with. But I do think some of these are worth a discussion. I mean, I don't know why noon on Election Day is some magic time period. I think for every other, you know, thing I've covered, it's like close of business or postmarked. But so that's an example of something that I don't really understand why we can't talk about that.
John Schwanis, are voters, let's say you have a situation where voters, many more of whom will be sending in mail-in ballots, obviously, in this election than likely ever before. Let's say you have some voters who, because the postal system just didn't get it there on time, doesn't have a ballot counted. How much is that going to fall on Republicans if that happens?
Well, yeah, certainly it would be unfortunate. I think even Republicans, everybody would agree it would be unfortunate if a Hoosier's vote is not accounted because of some circumstance beyond their control.
It depends on who they voted for.
So that would be would certainly be problematic. There was in fact a new organization that started up this week, a special interest group that is going to in fact be lobbying for an extension of that mail-in deadline, I believe, until the 8th of June. Now, whether that will fall on deaf ears, I don't know. I would just point out one thing that may seem, maybe I'm old school, but when you have a panel that comes together to discuss public policy, and I believe is subject to the state's open door law, how can anyone be penalized for putting forth discussion points regardless of whether they had been quote unquote agreed to by others outside the public forum? I thought that's what public meetings were all about, was to decide the policy and have a vigorous, robust discussion at that time.
Well, Indiana House Democrats sent a letter to the governor's office this week asking the state to better protect the safety of essential workers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports the state's Occupational Safety and Health Administration has seen thousands of non-formal COVID-19 complaints related to various safety issues.
In a letter to the governor last week, the party caucus notes that in a recent executive order, Governor Holcomb requires businesses to follow CDC guidelines. However, they say without strict enforcement, too many businesses are interpreting the guidelines as suggestions. Phil Giaquinta is the Indiana House Democratic Caucus leader. He says his staff has been hearing from essential workers that nothing is being done when they file complaints on IOSHA's website about workplaces not following safety guidelines.
That doesn't cut it. They have to, with the governor's backing, say, look, you need to adhere to the guidelines or, you know, maybe you're not going to be open for business.
The caucus is also asking the state to require PPE for essential workers and to make it easier for them to get workers' compensation if infected.
John Schwanis, is the state doing enough to protect the workers that still need to work?
Oh, I'm sure there are instances where it's not doing enough to protect those workers. The challenge here is, though, one of execution. How do you do it? This is all new to everyone involved, including the state officials who are mapping out the strategy for trying to police this. If the toughest task, I would say, is finding a cure for COVID-19, the second toughest might be how to police these organizations and these businesses once they start ramping up. As I've said before in previous weeks, it's that balance between sort of a Big Brother draconian, you know, hey, rat out your neighbor, send them a picture, and as New York City did, by the way, send us, if you see somebody violating the rules, send us a picture to this this phone number or text it. Well, they got a lot of photos of something other than people apparently not adhering to the protocols. So that was quickly abandoned. How do you do it? I don't know. I'm sitting here saying, I guess it could be better, but I don't know how.
Yeah. Nikki Kelly, we've heard a little bit on the daily press conferences with the governor and through reporters reaching out to the state about how many complaints, formal complaints, the state has received. But the number of complaints they've received versus the number of just verbal warnings they've sent out is a stark difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's minuscule that we're even giving any verbal warnings, and we've sent no cease and desist letters or anything like that. I actually don't even have any anecdotal evidence that we're enforcing anything. And I don't know exactly how they're counting, you know, how they investigate. Do they just call the owner up and say, are you doing X, Y, and Z? And if they say yes, then, you know, it's okay. You know, I don't think they have time to go visit these places and see it for themselves.
John Schwann has pointed this out, Ann Delaney, that enforcing this is difficult because, one, we're all doing this sort of for the first time in a lot of ways, and two, it's a staffing issue as well and a safety issue. But as we start to reopen businesses or allow businesses to reopen, I should say, isn't this going to become much more important as we all figure out this quote-unquote new normal of how to do business in a safe manner?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that, Brandon. And John, where do you start? You start with the complaints that go to the website, and you do an investigation of them. How do you open this to more commerce, the state to more commerce, when we're on a stay-at-home order and you've got essential workers fearing for their health? I mean, we're talking about the ones that have to operate, and they feel at risk. And it doesn't seem to me that it involves a lot. Let the state hire. Okay, we're talking about the lives of these workers. And when we see what happens, particularly in the African American and Latino communities now, where they're double, in some cases triple, the death rate from the coronavirus, we have to take it seriously. And if workers are going to the trouble of going to the website and making a complaint, they obviously feel strongly about it. And it seems to me it's incumbent upon the state to ensure their safety by having those employers follow the guidelines.
Mike O'Brien, as we start to look into the next several weeks and allowing businesses to reopen while changing their procedures to ensure their workers' safety, is it going to be important for the public to feel like the state and IOSHA has some teeth behind whatever orders the governor issues?
Well, sure, and I think it depends on if you're a regulated business, too. I mean, we have seen the governor threatened to, back when the carryout only orders were in place, and there were still restaurants operating around the state, allowing patrons to come in and sit down in the dining room and do all that. It directed ATC to pull liquor licenses or go suspend a license. The part of the challenge, I think, to John Schwannis's point, we're being asked, and the state is directing, and the federal government is directing, with these guidelines through the CDC and the Department of Health, guidelines for how we all behave as individuals. And so if you have an employer where certain employees don't buy into social spacing and washing their hands and other things, and other employees who are see that, it just gets complicated. And it's not because the employer has necessarily created a culture where they're just disregarding this advice, but you have varying degrees of compliance from just regular people all over the state and through different employers. So I think it is challenging, but the state does and will, certainly as things begin to open and more of these, and we'll see more and more of these complaints because more and more people are going to start going back to work.
Yeah, I was about to say, this probably won't be the last time we talk about this issue. Indiana State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box rebuffed questions this week about providing more specific information about COVID-19 outbreaks at nursing homes. While other states have released detailed nursing home information, like lists of COVID facilities with COVID, or lists of facilities rather, with COVID-19 cases, the state refuses to do so. In past weeks, Indiana state officials did discuss some specific outbreaks, but now Box says the state will only release aggregate data. She says reporting COVID cases and deaths is a, quote, personal thing between long-term care facilities, the residents, and their families.
Medicare and Medicaid regulations are requiring them to notify families of any positive cases and update them on additional positive cases and to update them on any deaths that occur in those facilities.
The Indiana Healthcare Association, which represents long-term care facilities, claims communication has been good between nursing homes and families. It argues there have only been a small number of communication lapses that shouldn't be a focus. Nikki Kelly, Dr. Box was asked directly multiple times this week, as was the governor today, in fact, why the state won't give out this specific information. Beyond we're not doing it, did we really get more of an answer?
No, I don't feel I'm clear. I mean, I can guess that they've gotten some pressure behind the scenes not to name these companies because, you know, they're trying their best and no one's saying that these companies have done anything wrong. But, you know, it seems clear to me that they believe the family and the residents should be able to have the information, but that it's not public information that should be shared.
John Schwannis, somebody on at the governor's press conference today asked a question, a reporter asked a question that they'd heard from someone who was trying to find a nursing home for their parent because that was just the next step in their journey at this point. But we're struggling with the idea that they couldn't know, for instance, or at least easily, which facilities they were looking at had COVID-19 patients and which didn't. Isn't that sort of exposing one of the flaws of not publishing more information about this stuff?
Sure. Oh, I think it's you'll get no argument from me. I think it's very problematic that state officials have decided not to release this information for the very reason you indicated. I mean, in the end, this is all more or less public information anyway, and I trust that some enterprising news organization, if it isn't already, will be tracking all of the death certificates and the locations of those deaths and the causes, and can retroactively, and that won't do much good for those families that are seeking a good place to put a parent or a loved one, but it may show disregard for information on the part of state officials that the public should have known. So the information will come out in the end, as is often the case when state officials try to keep things from the public and, you know, basically say, don't worry your pretty little head about this. We got it under control. It'll come back to bite them.
Mike O'Brien, this isn't quite an apples-to-apples comparison, but the state this week mostly has started publishing very detailed information about outbreaks at all of the prison facilities in the state, the number of offenders who have been diagnosed, the number of offenders who have died, the number of offenders who have been quarantined or isolated because of outbreaks in those facilities. Now, again, it's not completely apples to apples, but we're talking about long-term stay facilities, and a prison is a version of that. So why is the state fine publishing that information and not publishing information about nursing homes?
Because those are public facilities that have people that are being held by the state, and that's not the case in nursing homes. And so the state has an obligation to keep those facilities safe and secure, and the people in those facilities secure, and the rewards of the state. So it's not apples to apples at all. If you have a private nursing home, that it's not the state's job or their obligation to start calling out individual companies or releasing, you know, this information. Should the communication improve between families and the residents in these facilities? Absolutely. Nobody disagrees with that, and no one's not critical of that. But the state doesn't have an obligation in these facilities to release that kind of information.
Why does the state then even license these organizations, these businesses? Why do they inspect them? Of course they have an obligation.
Absolutely.
The state does, as a licensing agency, to ensure their safety. I think that's kind of a far stretch to make that argument.
And they fund them. So much of the tax money from Medicare and Medicaid go into supporting those nursing homes. And the question is, it seems to me, not just whether the employees are being tested adequately and all, it's staffing. And I think public, that question I thought was very, very poignant question at the press conference today, because people are looking at that and you want to know whether the staffing is adequate. And obviously, in some of these cases, it is not. And the public has a right to know that information. And it's shameful that the state is holding it back.
Nikki Kelly, very quickly, do you see this changing at this point?
I don't think so. They've really dug in their heels on this. Obviously, other states are giving this information out, but they are just refusing to.
All right.
Well, our nursing homes are at the bottom of everybody's list in terms of quality, and they don't want that out there because they're responsible for policing it.
All right. Well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.